bringing you the truth behind the news. Welcome to The New American.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Dragoo. We're glad that you decided to join us. So joining me here in the studio are my colleagues, Gary Benoit, who is the editor-in-chief of The New American Magazine, and one of our best researchers, Peter Rykowski. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, Paul.
Great to be on.
So we actually have a pretty good story that we're going to lead into, but we're going to, like I said, lead into that. Obviously, since taking over the government, the Biden administration has unleashed the most destructive border policies in U.S. history. It's obviously apparent now. We've been reporting it. It's been depressing, but nonetheless, it's kind of what we do here. Not depressing, but news. And sometimes news just is depressing. And in this case, this has been very depressing. We have estimates. And of course, we don't necessarily know because they're undocumented. There's a lot of unknowns. But some estimates say that we have at least 12 million illegals from coast to coast, mostly in big cities, some of them even in small towns. Peter, if you think of the town that I'm talking about, there was a report, I believe, not too long ago, a Wisconsin town, maybe about 8,000 to 10,000 people, and they had brought in about 800 to 900 illegals, somewhere around outside of Madison. I don't know if any of you remember this. This was only a couple months ago. And it made headlines because those 800 to 900 illegals were already overwhelming the system there. They were overwhelming the charity systems. They were overwhelming welfare and law enforcement as well. Law enforcement was reporting things like there were a lot of them driving without licenses and never explained how they got cars, because I'd be interested in that. It's like, how are these illegals getting cars? Because it's like, we know Americans who are having a hard time affording cars. I'd read reports, other reports too, and as an outdoorsman or pseudo outdoorsman, I don't want to presume too much, but for instance, they're going fishing without getting a permit. You know, in other countries, you don't really need a permit and they don't know. They don't know about bag limits. So that, you know, for all you lefties and conservation and things like that, which is actually not just lefties, because I agree with a lot of conservation rules. But so they're coming in, they're overwhelming the system. And this is obviously expected when you have this deluge of people. So at the center of this betrayal, and I think you guys would all agree, this is absolutely a betrayal, is this is the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Now, Mayorkas is a Cuban refugee. I don't know what significance there is to that, other than the fact that he clearly hates America. I don't know. He seems to be an enemy of the U.S. because he's orchestrating this. He's behind. He's at the center of it. Gary, I think it was last week where we played a clip from J.J. Carroll, who wrote the book Invaded, and the guy had been investigating this for quite some time. And he says this guy has been at the center of these policies, DACA policies and whatnot, for years before. He worked under Obama. And he's at the center of it all. He's orchestrating. He's working with others who are orchestrating it. Last week, he was grilled by the Senate at a Homeland Security hearing. And I want to play a clip from our own Senator Ron Johnson, who acknowledges two things in his line of questioning. One, that he's clearly doing this on purpose. And Senator Johnson wants to know, why are you doing this? You know, I guess he didn't want to presume because he hates America. So he's not presuming that. But he does seem to also imply something else. And after this, we're going to talk about it because maybe I'm wrong and maybe we don't need to talk about it. But he seems to be also implying that he may be somewhat of a sociopath, because he asks him, you know, do you feel bad at all for what is happening? That, you know, Rand Paul had been in that hearing. Senator Hawley had been in that hearing. And they cited all these crimes that had happened, shootings and stabbings and rapings at the hands of illegals. But let's listen to Senator Johnson here. And then we're going to come back and actually go into the good news about this front.
When you entered office, you reversed all those successful policies. And you opened up the border and you've created this catastrophe. And it is a catastrophe. You know, 6 million people, more than 6 million people, the 31 states have a population less than the number of people you've let in, you know, flooding these sanctuary cities. So I've got a very simple question. Why did you do it?
Senator.
Why did you reverse those policies? Why did you open up the border? Why did you create this catastrophe?
Senator, I respectfully disagree with the premise of your question. We did not open up the border. Senator, we enforced the law. we are facing.
Do you deny you reversed the Trump policies that had secured the border?
No, Senator.
You deny that?
No, Senator. That is not what I said. We enforce the law.
You reversed the Trump policies that had secured the border. Do you have any remorse? Do you have any regrets?
Senator, 2 points. One, very importantly, all of our hearts break for the victims of these heinous crimes and their loved ones. Secondly, the criminals who committed those crimes are responsible for their criminal conduct.
They wouldn't have been into this country had you not allowed them in.
Gary, he has zero remorse. Absolutely. The guy takes no responsibility whatsoever. Can you believe this?
I can, because I know, and of course we know in the John Birch Society and at the New American, and we've been waking up the people and telling the town about this for many years, that this whole thing is by design.
Yeah.
And of course we're talking about criminals. We're talking about criminals who are illegal aliens who commit criminal acts when they're here. But let's face it, the biggest criminals of all are the people who are orchestrating these policies, the people who are bringing about this invasion of America for the purpose of destroying our country.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the good news there. Now that we got that out of the way, that's that depressing reality. States are finally pushing back. Peter, my understanding is it's not finally. They've been working on legislation, and quite a bit of it has been enacted. And I don't feel like we haven't necessarily highlighted that as much as we've highlighted the depressing element of this. So tell us what's going on, which states are enacting what legislation. We do have some more tape from one of those state legislators in Florida where he talks about that as well. But tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so there have been a lot of states, quite a few states that have actually, in just in the past few months, enacted legislation pushing back against this open borders agenda by the Biden administration, actually enacting laws that would allow the state to enforce our immigration laws rather than allow the federal government to simply ignore them.
Yeah.
So a few months ago, we saw Texas enact a law, a very good law that makes illegal immigration a state crime and even allows the state to deport them back into Mexico. And then we've seen other states since then enact similar bills. So in Iowa, Oklahoma, Georgia, Arizona, and a few others, they've either considered or already enacted into law very similar bills like that.
Well, what are some of the parameters of these? I mean, you mentioned Texas. I remember if we're talking about the same one, we're thinking about the same one, this was challenged in court, right? The ability for Texas to arrest and deport illegals. Are we talking about that one?
Right. Yeah, that's the bill.
And did it go through now? Is it law?
It's not law yet. It is law, but it's been
It's challenged. It's being challenged.
Right. It's being stuck in court. Right now, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has issued a stay on the law, so they can't enforce it right now.
Well, it's stuck in court, Peter. Do you know if Texas is actually implementing the law, or are they standing by to see what the court does?
They're standing by. Unfortunately, there's still this mindset among state officials where if a federal court says something, no matter how ridiculous it is, they just follow along and with what the court says. So that's the unfortunate thing with that, but it's still really encouraging to see, you know, many other states follow these laws. Some of these states have looked at what's going on in Texas and tried to model their laws in a way that could prevent other challenges. Mm-hmm. But part of this is also simply the federal government angry that they can't simply do whatever they want,
right?
You know, that they're being challenged by the states, and the mindset among the federal judges, particularly the more left-wing judges, that, you know, everything the federal government does cannot be challenged, and you know, just a lack of respect for state sovereignty on their part. But yeah, it's really good to see what the states are doing nonetheless.
Well, tell us about Oklahoma. I think Oklahoma, that's breaking news, right? You had sent me an email this morning, right? Tell us about what Oklahoma, and have they had more luck than, say, Texas as far as implementation?
Well, in Oklahoma, the state legislator just pass the bill and send it to the governor for him to sign or veto. Governor Kevin Stitt actually hasn't said whether or not he'll sign the bill, but it's a very good bill. It's similar to what Texas passed in that it makes illegal immigration a state crime. So if you're an illegal alien in Oklahoma, that in and of itself is breaking state law. So you can be prosecuted for that.
Yeah.
The bill does not have a section regarding deporting illegals. That was the main thing in dispute in the Texas law. But still, any illegal aliens can be prosecuted under this bill, assuming it becomes law.
Simply amazing that someone would dispute deporting illegals who break the law. Because I believe that was the essence of the Texas bill. If you have been found guilty of a crime, you should be deported. You're already illegal. And I can't believe the times that we live in. Well, you mentioned Georgia and Iowa. What do we know about them?
Iowa was it's very similar to the Oklahoma bill, making illegal immigration a state crime. The illegals can choose to leave the country in order to avoid being sent to prison. So under the Iowa bill, but that one has been signed into law.
There we go.
It is taking effect in Iowa. There haven't been any challenges yet. But some of the officials have said that it's likely the federal government will try to challenge it at some point in the next few months.
Okay. Georgia, what happened in Georgia?
Similar thing. Illegal immigration will be a state crime, assuming that the governor signs it. All indications show that Brian Kemp, surprisingly, will sign into law.
Surprisingly.
Considering he's...
He's somewhat of a neocon, rhino,
he is,
rhino camp.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any idea, go back to Oklahoma, if what stint, or what's his name, Stitt?
Kevin Stitt.
Yeah, any idea what he may do? Has he signaled his intentions for the bill?
He has not, which is actually surprising because he's generally been a better governor compared to some of the more rhino people.
And he's got a pretty good AG. I've seen his AG in various hearings and things like that. And I like what I've heard from
the attorney general worked with the legislator in crafting this bill.
Yeah.
And he worked with them specifically to try to have the bill withstand any of these legal challenges in a federal court.
Okay. All right. So Florida has already enacted something as well, right?
Yeah, Florida has enacted they've gone somewhat of a different route than these other states. So in most of these other states, they've made illegal immigration a state crime.
Yeah.
Florida has not done that yet, but they've enacted some other really good bills.
Yeah.
One of them would ban any local governments or state agencies from accepting IDs issued to illegals from other states or other towns in other states.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunately happening a lot, especially many of the blue states.
Yeah.
So illegals are given driver's licenses, IDs, and then they can go to another state, and then the state basically will treat them as citizens because they have identification.
Would the other state, Peter, be able to tell that this person is illegal if he has identification from a different state?
They're supposed to mark on the ID that whether the person is a legal resident or not. So there are ways of knowing what the person's status actually is.
Yeah.
But under this bill, Florida will be, and any local government in Florida will be banned from accepting or recognizing
that ID. That. Well, let's listen to Florida State Representative Bernie Jacques. Is it Jacques? It looks like
Jacques.
Yeah, Jacques looks very French. Discussing these actions that Florida has taken to combat illegal immigration.
Illegal immigration, right? So since going to the legislature, I've worked on every immigration bill, partnering with my colleague, Representative Kyan Michael. And the first session, we brought mandatory E-Verify to the state of Florida. And this session, we passed two more immigration enforcement bills, one of which removes the ability of local governments to accept these IDs that are being issued by these nonprofits to illegal aliens. And also, we reclassified and upgraded the penalties for crimes for criminal illegal aliens. These are people who've been deported, came back across the open Biden borders and went on to commit more crimes. They will be dealt with more harshly with more penalties for crimes they commit when they come back to Florida. If they come back to Florida, which I don't think they will because we're pretty tough here.
Correct me if I'm mistaken. You're a legal immigrant yourself,
that's
right?
Correct. That's
from
correct.
Haiti.
Correct.
And you are the one spearheading the way, making sure that we have legal immigration here in Florida.
Absolutely. There's a right way and there's a wrong way.
that was interesting there at the end. I'm an immigrant. I'm a legal immigrant. We have colleagues here, Gary, who have a family out in other countries waiting to come here through the legal system. We know that the legal immigration system is just screwy, and it has been for a very, very long time. Peter, you brought up something else that was interesting. You sent an interesting email, and I got to say, I am not surprised. Can you tell us a little bit more about this? I don't know if it's a Breitbart exclusive, but apparently the Ukraine funding bill, Gary, have you heard about this? The Ukraine funding bill includes sneaky money for, what is it called? Refugee and entrant assistance. Peter, can you tell us anything more about it? I'm not surprised. They are so good at being devious.
Yes, and not only do they have no funding for the U.S. southern border in this bill, but they actually have provisions in the bill to expand more mass migration to this country.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of provisions in this bill. One would spend almost $500 million on refugee resettlement in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
Presumably for Ukrainian refugees, but there's really nothing in the wording of the bill that would limit it to Ukrainians. So it could be basically anyone, just more refugees in general. So
that's almost, just how they package it.
Yes, almost $500 million. And then there's another provision that would give $3.5 billion to the State Department for migration and refugee assistance. That's what they call it. And once again, there's nothing in the bill preventing this funding from being used to expand, put more, migrants into this country.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's not just illegal immigration, but it's just massive uncontrolled migration where it's just giving a blank check to just anyone who wants to come into this country for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
Which is just very destabilizing considering that many of these people have no understanding or love or respect for this country and for our form of government.
Yeah.
So really our government is, in Congress is enabling, just a very destructive
act. It absolutely is. It is. It's, I was listening to Michael Yon. He's a journalist who has traveled all over the world, and he was at the Darien Gap. He was all over Central America. And he mentioned, I'm not sure which Central American country he mentioned, that he was there. He heard that Mayorkas was going to be there. He showed up in choppers and whatnot. And he's working with a lot of these NGOs that were also helping the fund who are fueling this invasion. Gary, did you ever think you'd see this so blatant in all the years that you've been covering politics? And
because of the way you framed the question, Paul, I'll have to say no. What is happening is something we've warned about, but the fact that it is so transparent, it is so in your face, that part surprises me.
Yeah.
But there is a silver lining to it. The fact that it is so much in your face means that people can see it. And people are waking up.
Well, I also wonder if it's a last-ditch effort on their part.
Yeah, it could be a sign that they're desperate. And I want to mention, too, that at the beginning of the segment, Paul, you very nicely, diplomatically, referred to the Biden administration.
Uh-huh.
But things are so bad in terms of the administration working to destroy the country. Maybe the word regime would be more appropriate.
Yes. Yes, it certainly seems to be. I mean, especially the way they've weaponized the DOJ. We've gone back to the doom and gloom. This was supposed to be, it's absolutely good news to see that the states are pushing back. We obviously would love to see more effective results. I think anyone listening, watching it, will say, man, we wish we had more. We wish we had more states. And there, are there others? I'm sure there's others that are thinking, especially red states.
There are a lot more that have introduced bills,
mm-hmm.
and there are a lot more that could potentially pass in the future. These are just only a handful of the states that have just started to take action.
Yeah.
But as Gary said, people are waking up and. We're seeing this with these bills in the state legislators.
Mm.
10 years ago, there was an effort in, I think, Arizona and Alabama to pass similar legislation, but it was only two or three states.
Yeah.
Now we're seeing a lot of states actually enact this. And it's still only baby steps because there's, number one, a lot more they could do on this issue. There's a lot more than simply making illegal immigration a state crime. They could take away every benefit that the states already give to illegals, you know, in-state tuition for school, welfare,
get rid of
housing.
The magnets.
Right.
And that's going to be key to the deportation efforts, because no one's rounding these people up. They're not throwing them in boxcars. They're not throwing them in paddy wagons. It's not going to happen. But a key point might be take away the magnets, take away the benefits and whatnot,
right,
and then they'll self-deport.
And then a second thing I would add is that states need to get bolder in actually enforcing the U.S. Constitution rather than just bowing down to whatever a federal court tells them to do.
Oh, good point.
Because we have this mindset, as I mentioned earlier, that whenever a federal court issues a ruling, it can be the most ridiculous ruling ever created. But the states, even the conservative, Republican-controlled ones, will just go along with that. And states need to actually step up and nullify any federal court rulings if they clearly violate the U.S. Constitution. And the rulings here against some of these migration bills, like in Texas, those are unconstitutional rulings. The Constitution clearly allows Texas and other states to enact and to enforce these laws.
And of course, state officials have an obligation to do so. And a lot of people don't think about this, but it's not just federal officials who take an oath to the U.S. Constitution. State officials do so as well. And so when the federal government is running roughshod over the Constitution, it is up to state officials to say, enough is enough. We also have taken an oath to this Constitution. We're not going to allow the Constitution to be violated within our states.
I'm going to quote Rage Against the Machine here. I won't do what you tell me. I didn't say the first part of that, but I just thought about that, because nullification, it has such an official diplomatic sounding. That's what it is. It's a very nice sounding diplomatic term. But what it essentially is the states saying, I'm not going to do what you tell me. We need to get to that point. The states run by reasonable people who actually care about this country need to start telling the federal government, I will not do what you tell me. And I think we need to leave it at that, because we have more semi-good news in the next segment, where we're going to look at what seems to be at least an effort, hopefully we can get more out of that, of the RNC and the Trump campaign attempting to restore election integrity and protect the vote this coming November. We're going to be right back.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper, and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world, using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Welcome back, folks. So, the RNC and the Trump administration, or Trump campaign, it's not the administration yet, recently announced, Peter, that they are, what did they say? They're unveiling a historic 100,000 person, we have that up on the screen there, 100,000 person strong election integrity program. I read this and I marked it all up, but Peter, I want to get your take on it, some of the highlights there, and is this as exciting as they're making it sound?
Well, I guess the best answer is yes and no. So what's going on is that the RNC...
Thanks for being clear.
So the RNC will be stationing various poll watchers, attorneys, and many of these swing states and a few non-swing states like Texas and California, New York.
Yeah.
And they will be more closely monitoring the election processes in those states. For example, early voting, voting on election day, the mail-in vote processes, what happens after the election. For example, audits that could potentially happen. So basically, they're saying they want to have more people just have a, look more closely what's going on. And then also with the intention of if they see anything that looks suspicious or anything where the state officials are violating any state laws, they can quickly file lawsuits against that. And that's certainly a good thing. You know, it's good to, pay close attention to
what's going on.
It's better
than nothing, right?
Right. It's a lot better than nothing. Now, where I said no is because there's a lot more that could be done to restore election integrity. This is only, one very small aspect.
Yeah.
How about restoring paper ballots?
Right. I mean, there's a lot that's not mentioned in this. Most importantly or broadly, the very... important need for structural reforms to our election laws. For example, paper ballots, precinct voting, voting on election day only rather than election month.
Limiting the mail-in or the ballot harvesting scams.
Right, yeah, completely doing away with that rather than simply monitoring it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a good initiative. It's better, a lot better than nothing, but... what we really need is for, state officials and state legislators to actually change these laws, because many of these laws in and of themselves are very bad laws. So filing a lawsuit trying to get the state to comply with the law, better than nothing, but there's a lot more and a lot better things they could be doing.
Well, I wanted to mention that because, as you've likely noticed as well, aggressive litigation is mentioned multiple times. The word's aggressive, and there's all sorts of litigation that's mentioned. For instance, it says here that in the event of a new regularity or problem, which we can almost guarantee, RNC lawyers and the volunteer attorneys that they have coordinated will provide rapid response services to resolve the issue. And then here's another one. Under the leadership of Chairman Whatley and co-chair Trump, the RNC executing an unprecedented legal strategy fighting in courtrooms across the country. I should also mention that the presser mentions that there's some of that is already happening. There's already courtroom action happening right now to, I guess, secure preemptive, which is a really good sign, because the first thing I thought about when I was reading this is it's like, yeah, but this happens in real time. Litigation takes time. We've seen it. It always does. I mean, how does, they make it sound like it's just going to be on the spot. It's not. We know it's not. And we know we don't have that much time. If it's stolen, we only have what? How long do we have, Gary, before the inauguration? It's a couple months, right?
Well, it's from November to January. January 20th, I believe.
Yes. Oh, and here's it. The RNC team of lawyers is already aggressively engaging in legal battles around the country. Apparently, so far, the RNC has engaged in 82 election integrity lawsuits in 25 states. So it's good to see that they have recognized this. I want to go back to some of the things that they should be doing that are not mentioned in here. You mentioned paper ballots. That's going to be really, I think that's going to be a long, long battle to get there. But I want to mention something that, and this is going to be a shameless plug, but I didn't plan it this way. So we interviewed Dr. David Clements, Professor David Clements. He is the author and the producer of Let My People Go. He has spent the last 3 to 4 years, I don't remember how much, investigating how they steal elections, how they rig elections. And so, when I asked him the same question, it's like, well, what's the answer? I was assuming the same thing, and I think we still assume that. And he didn't argue as far as paper ballots, same day voting, precinct voting, things like that. But when it comes to the machines, he said, if we don't get rid of the machines, we have to close the loop. And he gave the most, the best explanation as far as how the machines, because I feel like we've heard competing narratives regarding machines, ballot harvesting, ballot harvesting, that's what it is, right? When they go at night and they dump ballots into these boxes and things like that. And he said they work together. So since they're connected, the machines are connected, and it's an open loop, they're able to see how many votes they need. So when we see these videos of people coming with wheelbarrows and boxes of ballots, what they're doing is they're seeing where the vote is on a particular race. They bring the needed ballots and they dump them, and that's how you have the trend change. And if they have to, they'll stop the vote. And this is what we saw
in the swing states.
Yeah, this is what we saw. They stopped the vote. Whatever excuses they'll use. For instance, in Fulton County, Georgia, they said there was a water break, but they stopped the vote in multiple places. Philadelphia, I think, as well. Some places here in Wisconsin, and they do that so they could bring in and dump the ballots, the extra ballots.
Well, they stopped the counting.
The counting, yes. Right. Vote. Thank you for. Mm-hmm. I'm glad. Please correct me if I do that again. So it's good. It's good that they've woken up. But my understanding is also that the Trump administration knew when it was the Trump administration that there was going to be an attempt to steal the election. And a lot of people accuse him of not having done enough. Apparently, word is that Trump's response was, we're going to win so big that it's going to be too big to rig, which he's saying now. And obviously that did not pan out, did it, Gary?
No, obviously did not, because we know who's sitting in the White House. But what did pan out is it's pretty striking. It's pretty obvious that the election was stolen, regardless of what the opinion cartel is claiming. And actually, I realized something was wrong myself. And I'm no election expert, but I realized the day after the election, because I've never seen that before, where they simply stopped the counting. And Trump is leading in various swing states. And then they resume the counting, and they'll have, let's say, another 100,000 votes that come in.
Yeah.
And of those 100,000 votes that come in a state where it's pretty close, but Trump is leading,
yeah,
you might have 2,000 votes or 3,000 votes for Biden and, for Trump.
And then
98,000 votes for Biden. And it didn't make any sense whatsoever, unless, of course, the election was being stolen. So, you know, right away, I realized that something was wrong. And of course, millions of people did.
Well, now, to be fair, Trump does have some of the blame with the, you know, lack of, aggressive action right after the 2020 election. But we should also not forget about the state legislators, because during COVID, the executive branch, some of the state and federal courts use that as an opportunity to massively expand mail-in voting. And election rules are... That belongs to the state legislators. Even the U.S. Constitution itself says state legislators are in charge for making election rules.
Yeah.
Like, that belongs to them. And before the 2020 election, the state legislators did not step in to override or to nullify the rulings by the federal courts, state courts, the state officials. So they didn't do anything about that. In fact, in some cases, they codified those changes, those unconstitutional changes that really ruined election integrity in many of those states. So a lot of the responsibility does fall to the state legislators for restoring the situation that we're in.
Well, that wasn't even a lot of the legislatures didn't even codify or approve any of that. For instance, in Pennsylvania, they passed put drop boxes and they brought in massive mail-in voting. Overriding, the legislature didn't approve any of that. So that happened quite a bit, is where they brought in all these different ways to vote, and they expanded mail-in voting and drop boxes. And none of that passed through the legislatures. It passed, like you said, Gary, because we were under COVID and as an emergency measure.
That was used as the pretext.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in another interview that we have here in our new issue is with Michael Gableman.
Yes.
Michael Gableman is a former Supreme Court justice here on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And he was tasked by the legislature after 2020 to investigate what happened just here in Wisconsin. And I had a long conversation with him, and you can find that. We'll put that in the description there. And he essentially, first of all, he was not allowed to really do a whole, not a whole lot, but I mean, he was obstructed. Eventually, they killed the investigation because they didn't really want to know the truth. But I mean, what he uncovered is already really, really damning. He uncovered Zuckerberg finance grants and organizations coming in and essentially hijacking elections, the election process in certain cities, in Green Bay, in Madison, in Milwaukee, and a few others. And so what they did is they brought these people and they brought them under the guise of bringing in PPE and ways to protect them during the COVID so they can process the election. But they didn't. What they did is instead they changed the process. They had secret Wi-Fi connections. They did all sorts of shenanigans. And when Michael Gableman brought this to the attention of the Wisconsin legislature, instead of them saying, man, we need to hear more about this, they cut off his investigation.
And not only that, but the media claims to this day that there is no evidence of widespread vote fraud sufficient to change the election results.
Well, this is the same way they do with the climate change debate. They say that there's consensus. And what they do is they silence, they castigate, they banish anyone, a lot of these legitimate scientists with the opposite opinion, or those who say, look, there's no evidence that we are that man-made catastrophic climate change is going to destroy us all. But then they silence those people and then they say, everyone else agrees that this is what's coming. This is the same. It's always the same tactic with these people. That's why we have censorship. We've been censored. We've been talking about. We talked about censorship yesterday with Dennis. This is their game plan. Their game plan is quash, silence anyone who says the things that they're not allowed to say or that disrupts their narrative or might awaken people to the truth.
But the good news is that countless people see it. And a lot of people are working to bring about election integrity. And I know there was a meeting of sheriffs last week that we covered, Richard Mack's group. And one of the speakers there was Mike Lindell. And Mike Lindell was talking about this petition drive that he initiated, not just one petition drive, but a separate petition drive for every single county in the United States. So we're talking about several thousand counties to get back to paper ballots.
Yeah. Well, the awakening is definitely happening. That's another thing you won't hear if you're watching the mainstream. I mean, we pay attention to media because we're in the media. But if you look at the most popular voices in media, it's alternative media voices. It absolutely is.
Right. And it didn't used to be.
It didn't, but it's like, look who's become alternative. For instance, now I think Tucker Carlson's considered alternative. Mm-hmm. You know, he's up there. There's others who are doing very, very well. We are, of course, we've been growing. And meanwhile, the mainstream is laying off, from the Los Angeles Times to the New York Times to Gannett and Lee. They're all laying off. They've been getting rid of reporters because they can't afford them. The trend is absolutely undeniable.
How long do you think it will take, Paul, before the New York Times starts to be considered is alternative media because they're totally swamped by what is today called alternative media?
Well, I don't care I want people to recognize them for what they are. They are a propaganda arm of the regime, the deep state regime, and in larger part, the global conspiratorial regime. That's what these people are. I mean, they've had some highlights. For instance, some would say, well, look what they did with the Pentagon Papers and whatnot. You know, that was decades ago. But they are, and we know that's what they are. Washington Post, same thing. Harwood, who was the editor at large of the Washington Post in 1992, he wrote that piece, Ruling Class Journalists.
Right.
Right. And he outs them. He says, these journalists that we have, they're not just reporting foreign policy.
No, they're making.
They're creating it.
Mm-hmm. We can find also many examples of where the mainstream media completely ignored really huge stories.
Like the Hunter Biden laptop.
Right, yeah. That was what I was thinking.
But wasn't that Russian disinformation?
No, but this is a good point, Gary, because then they bought the disinformation. That's how you know there's tools and stooges, because it's like 51 former intelligence agencies say this is Russian. This, well, those were the, that's who's feeding the propaganda. They're the ones who are facilitating the propaganda. They're obviously directly tied to the deep state. They're doing the bidding, and they want to create a certain narrative because they're creating a result. They created the result that they wanted, and that was to install Biden and push out and keep Trump out. So we've veered a little bit away from that, but I'm glad to see that the RNC seems to at least be taking this seriously.
I think it's a step in the right direction, but it's one of many steps, and we need to keep that in mind as well, because as you pointed out, Peter, when you were asked how good a thing this is, your answer was, well, some good, some bad, but let's not look at what the RNC is doing in a vacuum.
Yeah, good
let's
point.
Not look at what Trump is doing in a vacuum, because there are many wonderful people, and of course, one you pointed to who's on the cover of the New American, Dr. Clements, who's working to bring about election integrity. Dr. Frank, who is on our Speaker's Bureau, has been working to bring about election integrity, and he's been going to various counties throughout the country to inform the people there and to bring about the impetus to move back to paper ballots. So a lot of people are doing a lot of things.
Well, and I'll mention this last thing. There actually are counties already that have gone to paper ballots. I think we reported the New American last week on one in Texas where they did a whole election by hand counting paper ballots. In Dr. Clements' movie, Let My People Go, there are several headlines there at the end showing how election integrity has been implemented. So this is good. People are waking up. It sounds like the RNC Trump campaign at least has lawyers on standby. They say they're going to get 100,000 lawyers, and not lawyers, but volunteers, some of them, which include lawyers, I suppose. So this is definitely a good sign. The people are awake. Now it's time to keep getting ready, and we're going to see what's going to happen in November. And by the way, they have a way for people to get involved, because if you go to www.protectthevote.com, they have a bunch of states where you can volunteer, you can help in this effort. And so if you can do that and you're available, it sounds like you probably should. Thank you, guys. We're going to come back with another feel-good story, and that's about the labor market.
Hey, America. How tired are you of mainstream corporate media's biased narratives and manipulated news? Their dishonesty and attempts to influence this generation have been exposed, put on display for anyone who's even half paying attention. But the New American Magazine has been an honest source of news and commentary for over 50 years. This is your opportunity to receive the stalwart of principled journalism at a deep discount. Picture a beautifully published magazine arriving at your doorstep twice a month, packed with insightful stories written with integrity. It's also available digitally on the New American's mobile app. Get up to speed with intelligent coverage from a freedom perspective. Right now, for a limited time, The New American is available to radio listeners at a 25% discount on a new subscription. Visit thenewamerican.com/radio25 and receive 25% off. Subscribe today at thenewamerican.com/radio25. Self-reliance. It's not a phrase we hear much in our culture these days. It might conjure up images of pioneers, the West, rifles, strapping men, and strong women. But what does it mean for us in today's world? The New American Magazine has just released its latest collector's edition, Self-Reliance, Foundation of Freedom. In it, the New American authors outline the necessity of self-reliance for a free people, tips for self-reliant living, and the importance of not giving up hope. This unique edition includes articles on the self-sufficiency of the founders, preparing for a worst-case scenario, firearms, financial self-reliance, the importance of community, and many other topics by expert writers. Now, for a limited time, The New American is offering a bundle of three collector's editions, Self-Reliance, The Great Reset, and Trump World, for just $19.95. A great stocking stuffer, available at shopjbs.org. Visit shopjbs.org today.
All right, we're back, folks. So we have a cool story, and I think cool actually applies to this. And it's good news. It's on the labor front. It turns out that Gen Z, and for those of you who are watching and you're like, what is Gen Z? Apparently it's those born between 1997 and 2012. Well, Gen Z is picking up their tool belts, they're skipping college, and they're getting to work. So the Wall Street Journal did this report, and I'm going to highlight some of the main points there, and we're going to report, and then we're going to discuss. So apparently enrollment in vocational training programs is surging as overall enrollment in community colleges and four-year institutions has fallen. That's not necessarily a bad thing, is it? The number of students enrolled in vocational-focused community colleges rose 16% last year to its highest level since the National Student Clearinghouse began tracking that data in 2018. The ranks of students studying construction trades rose 23% during that time, while those in programs covering HVAC and vehicle maintenance and repair increased 7%. Now, the median pay, now this is certainly good news because this is going to bring more in, for new construction hires rose 5.1% to $48,089 last year. By contrast, apparently new hires in professional services earned an annual $39,000, which is up 2.7% from 2022. Now, what this means is this is the fourth year that median annual pay for new construction hires was higher than those in professional services and information sectors like accountants and IT maintenance. And it singles southeastern part of Pennsylvania in the report where it says someone graduating 5 years ago from trade schools might have made $35,000 a year. Well, apparently now they're making closer to $60,000 a year. Now, the journal talked to a young man from California who said why he wanted to go into welding. And he said that, you know, during the COVID scandemic, he saw his parents kind of like they were relegated to the screen and they would just stare at. And he's like, well, I don't want to do that my life. And he also said that he liked playing with fire. I think we had a picture of them there doing that. So apparently this and demand is going up, too, for apprenticeships, which let students combine work experience with course of study. And so they get to go to work right away. They get to start making money. Apparently, in a survey of high school and college age people by software company Jobber last year, 75% of high schoolers said that they would be interested in vocational schools offering paid apprenticeships. You know, there's a lot of benefits to this. And one of them, they said also, is we don't have to incur student debt. We could get to working right away. This is good news on so many fronts. First of all, because we need people to do this stuff. I mean, I live in somewhat of a small town and it takes forever to get the plumber out. Construction workers are hard to find. I was a grease monkey? Is that what they call it? That the derogatory term? I mean, I was a mechanic for many years, and so I actually started in blue collar and I came this way. But we need people who know how to work with their hands, and this is another reason that I'm encouraged by Gen Z, which Peter, I believe you are, because I feel we're coming full circle. You know, between from Gen X, from the boomers to Gen X, and then to the millennials, they veered, I think, in directions that I don't think has done us a whole lot of favor. I mean, your generation, I guess you guys are the boomers. You ignored the conspiracy and so did the Xers. And then we got into IT and whatever, and people stopped learning how to work with their hands. It's like, I got to teach my son how to work with his hands because he likes screens as well and things like that. But Gary, what do you make of all this?
I think it's a very positive trend. And I think it's a very positive trend for a couple of reasons. One reason you identified, and that is we do need good plumbers and electricians and so forth. And
we need to know
there really
to fix
is
things.
No reason to go to college unless you need to go to college in order to do what you want to do for the rest of your life. If you want to be a doctor, for example, or a lawyer, you would need to go to college. But other people want to do other things, and that is tremendous. But the other reason, of course, it's a positive trend, is because of the cesspools that college has become.
Yes.
In terms of the propaganda, in terms of taking good people who go into college, who love God, family, and country, and they come out of college, and they hate God, family, and country because of these colleges have become indoctrination centers.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, have you been keeping up what's happening at Columbia University, Peter? Have you heard?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's been a disaster there with the anti-Israel protests, and them needing to actually send law enforcement in to keep everything under control there.
Yeah.
So that's a really good, timely example of, you know, the problems of, you know, the left-wing indoctrination in colleges, basically teaching, you know, the students there basically to be left-wing activists rather than to actually learn, you know, some type of skill that'll actually benefit them in life and help them to contribute to society.
Well, not only that, but they're apparently, I think it's like $89,000 for a degree at Columbia. And now, because of how dangerous the campus has gotten, they're telling them, they're sending them home and they want them to do remote learning. And this is an Ivy League school. I don't think those parents are paying $90,000 for a degree so their kids could come back home or, you know, and learn. That's absolutely ludicrous. But go on, Peter. Looks like you want to jump in.
Well, when I was growing up in high school and before going to college, there was this basically implication among the high school's faculty, you know, staff, all of that, and a whole lot more, that everybody needs to go to a four-year college to get a, you know, degree in some liberal arts or, you know, science field. And the problem with that was, I mean, number one, as you said, there are a lot of other vocations that are very important. But then also with all this pressure to, you know, go to a four-year school, many kids would just go, they would get a degree that they weren't particularly interested in. Yeah. And then they graduate, then they don't really know what to do after that. And then they're still in a whole lot of debt.
Yeah.
So for this vocational schooling, which actually is pretty normal in other countries, like, for example, in Switzerland, it's normal for everyone to get an apprenticeship in some type of job like this.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, really showing people that, hey, there are other things you can do that you can do well, that can benefit society, that doesn't involve taking up this student debt and, you know, facing this indoctrination in the left-wing campuses.
Right. And they come, a lot of, another popular or common story is that they pay all this money, they get some sort of humanities or liberal arts degree. And like you said, they come out and, you know, there might not be, well, I guess you didn't say that, but they're, you know, they pay all this money, they're indoctrinated, but they also can't get jobs, or they feel entitled and they feel that they should come out right out of school and make, you know, $70,000-$80,000 a year. And that's not the case either. Now, in my case, I was able to avoid journalism school and still get into journalism. When I realized that I wanted to do journalism, I also realized I didn't want to go back to school. I didn't want to spend, you know, two years, whatever I have left after I took my core classes and spending in journalism. So I just needed to convince one editor to hire me, because I realized that a lot of the entry-level jobs, they were still looking for people with J degrees. So I was able to convince one editor out of like 35 that I applied to hire me. And I made a go of it. I mean, before my 1 year, my first year in journalism was up, I had won a national first place award for investigative reporting and whatnot. So there's also ways to do that. And I remember, because I worked with everyone who I worked with there had J degrees. And they were a little bit different for me in the sense that I was the only conservative. And this is in a Montana town. Like, it's a rural Montana town, you know, a few thousand people here and there. And still, they were very, they had leftist ideas. They abided by all of them. And so that indoctrination is really strong. When you spend 3-4 years around the same people, the echo chamber becomes overbearing.
And of course, there's the dumbing down of the students as well. I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that in most colleges, maybe almost every college, that it's become the new high school.
Oh.
That people are learning in college today once what they once learned in high school. And
yeah.
Of course, Dr. Duke Pesto, who's been on this program, and he is the head of Freedom Project Academy, which is a sister organization to the New American Magazine and the John Birch Society, which teaches a classical education. But Dr. Duke Pesta is also a college professor.
Yeah.
He teaches college courses. And, you know, he's told me, he probably has told you as well, Paul, that he now has students whom he teaches on the college level who have not read a single book. not read a single book through their entire career.
Wow.
K through 12. And they're entering college not having read a single book.
Well, I didn't know they were still doing that. Because, I mean, I remember we had tons of reading assignments. And, we had Mark Twain's books and we had Dickinson's books. And when
isn't Mark Twain racist?
Well, maybe they don't do that anymore.
They're also saying that it's racist to tell people to write grammatically correct.
That's true. They are. Well, I mean, it sounds funny, but that's the reality in today's world.
And that's especially happening in universities. Holy moly. Well, I'm glad to see. I'll mention one last point, and that is that another reason a lot of these Gen Zers are skipping college is because they're saying that with the emergence of AI, some of these white-collar jobs won't be available. And I think there's a lot for that. There's a lot to that.
Well, there's a lot to that, but how about somebody who's trained to be a doctor who does not know how to practice medicine because he got so little training?
Well, yeah.
How about somebody who's supposed to be a journalist? Because you were mentioning journalism, but how good are the people, how good writers are the people who are graduating today from journalism school?
Well, journalists can't write in general, but so the bar is very low on that. But it's the critical thinking that I noticed was lacking in a way. It seems like a lot of the schooling and the education, what it does is it kind of gives you these rules. And so, me approaching from, I was a collaborative writer. That was my history once I approached journalism. And so I approached things from, how to tell the stories. And I put a little more storytelling into my reporting and things like that. But I wasn't hindered by these rules that they had learned, for instance. And so I guess I'm more of a magazine writer. But yeah, it's a... I don't think you get a whole lot, especially if you go to journalism school. I don't think I would recommend that at all. But
And then they talk about creative writing. Well, let's take a creative writing course, but shouldn't all writing be creative?
You would think, yeah. Well, it's still different because if you're going to do objective journalism, which nobody does anymore, you should avoid. It's not going to be very creative in the sense that when you use certain adjectives and things like that, then you inject. Your opinion.
But there's still basic things. Number one, you need to have something to say, right?
Yeah.
Because if you really don't have anything to say, you really shouldn't be writing. So you have something to say, and then you say it as clearly.
Yes.
As clearly and as succinctly as you can. No wasted words.
Right.
Be clear and communicate what you want to say and say it as persuasively as you can. And I would say there's creativity that goes into that.
Well, especially if you're writing features. Features is definitely a place, if you're in journalism, where you can apply your creative writing. So good on these kids.
Okay. Paul, we're probably running out of time. But
I think we are.
But before we sign off, we probably should say that there are some good colleges. I mean, there are very few. Maybe we could count them on one hand, but... I could think of Hillsdale College, for example, and
Liberty,
Cedarville. So there are a handful.
Yes, and we need good universities. I know there's some in Florida too. I think Mark Ruffo has been working with certain universities in Florida to oust a lot of the woke nonsense and things like that. And you're absolutely right. We need good universities. We need to have a society that. Where people who can work with their hands can get the training,
right.
and they can get and they can serve society, they can be a benefit to society, and then those who do who do like us, we like to read and sit in front of the computers. Mm-hmm. I do like that, I like finding out what's happening and doing this and whatnot, and having been a blue collar worker and now a white collar worker, I like white collar work better. So but we need our society. We need to cater.
But you know, if your car breaks down, Paul, you might be able to fix it.
Well, I fix my cars all the time.
I would not be able to do that.
I fix all my cars. I have hundreds of thousands of miles on them. I keep them up. So that still benefits me, that training. So good on them. Great news. Good to see this happening. Good to see the RNC trying to install or restore elections, or at least secure the elections. And good on states taking action against illegal immigration. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of The New American Daily. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news, and join us again tomorrow.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect, but the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose. A thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon.
Are you fed up with where our nation is headed? Here at the John Birch Society, we know how to fix a reckless, corrupt, and out-of-control government. It starts with patriots like you. We believe the only way to liberty and national sovereignty is to not only understand what's in our founding documents, but demand that every elected official adhere to them. The Constitution is America's only solution. Join the John Birch Society today. Visit us at jbs.org.